Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon here on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Dan Strauss is here with me. Ian Geis is not. He'll be back on Monday with Frank. And Colin Jeffries here now to talk about showbiz. Hi, Colin. How are you?
Doing well. How are you today, Paul?
Just fine. So this is the showbiz segment of the show. And we were not on last week because it was Thanksgiving weekend. And we all took Friday off. And so we have a lot of movies to catch up on, but there are also two new movies that are opening this week in St. Louis.
Yes.
I did not see either of the new movies, one of which I will never see because it stars Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, I didn't see that either. Man Down, and I haven't heard anyone who liked it.
Okay.
So I'd say Man Down might be all right to skip.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the other one, which you did see, which is called Manchester by the Sea?
Yes.
Which stars Casey Affleck.
Yeah, and you're going to likely hear quite a bit of Oscar buzz around this. And unlike The Revenant last year, which I thought was just more an exercise in survival than a particularly great movie, this is one of my favorite movies of the year.
Wow, okay.
Manchester by the Sea. Casey Affleck plays Lee Chandler, a sort of seemingly down-on-his-luck janitor who lives in Boston. He has an older brother, played by Kyle Chandler, who passes away, not unexpectedly. He had health issues, we come to find out. Passes away. He has a son, a 16. Kyle Chandler's character has a son who now needs to be taken care of because his mother's no longer in the picture. This is what the setup of the movie is. So Casey Affleck has to go back to the small town of Manchester, that is in Massachusetts, but not Boston, where he grew up. He has to go back there and sort out affairs for this, his little nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sort of the framework of the movie. How this is just a simple story. I love simple stories. Mm-hmm. There's not a huge amount of twists or anything. It's not about that. Instead, it's finding out what made Lee the person that he is. Why does he get drunk and go fight in bars? Why does he swear at tenants at the apartment complex where he works? Why is he just kind of this surly guy?
Mm-hmm.
And why does he have this seemingly inappropriate relationship with his nephew? Not inappropriate in any bad way, just the uncle that does things that clearly are not okay. If you're a parent, you know you have this, your child has this uncle or aunt that does all the things they're not supposed to with the kid. Mm-hmm. They give him candy or they speak inappropriately, show him the wrong movies, things like that. That's kind of the relationship he has with his little nephew. But this is much more complex. So why did he leave this little town? Why does he have this seemingly dead-end job in Boston? And instead of just laying it out and telling you, oh, this is why things are, this movie hops around a bit in time. The first time you see a flashback in this film, you're probably not going to realize that it's a flashback at first. And then you'll be like, oh, wait, Kyle Chandler's dead. How's he talking to Lee here? It's not some vision that he's having. It's actually just bouncing back and forth in time, but there's no distinct cut. Okay, now you're in a flashback. There's no dream fade sequence. It's just like the next scene is something happening. Lee's character was formed by what we saw by tragedy. I'm not going to say anything else, because when you discover what that tragedy is, it is a punch to the gut. Like, it's tough, and it's supposed to be. And this story is seeing, is there redemption for him? Can he rebuild and be the person that he needs to be?
Can he get his act together and be this guy's uncle and be responsible?
Yes. That's what we're looking for in this. And again, it's a story that we've seen the framework of. I've never seen anything quite like this.
Hmm. Now, Michelle Williams is also in this.
Yes, and I believe the New York Film Critics just gave her Best Supporting Actress. She's great in it, but she's not in it very much. She might have, in a two-hour movie, I don't know, 10 minutes of on-screen time,
maybe
12 or 15. She's excellent. It has one of my favorite scenes of the year involving her. She's very good. But this is a Casey Affleck vehicle, along with the young man. Oh, gosh, I'm going to forget his name. I feel horrible. The young man alongside him who plays the teenager. He's just so good.
Let me just say, while we're talking about Casey Affleck, people hear that name and they go, is he related to Ben Affleck? Yeah, it's his younger brother.
Yes.
And he appeared in a movie that I believe Ben Affleck directed more than 10 years ago called Gone Baby Gone.
And was excellent in it.
Was excellent.
Everything about that movie was good.
Yeah.
This is Casey Affleck's best performance by a margin.
You would also know him if you have not seen Gone Baby Gone. He was also in the Ocean's 11 movies.
He was the doofy brother that
teamed up with Scott Kahn.
Yes.
Jimmy Kahn's son.
Yes. Casey Affleck is going to get a Best Actor nod for this and deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely deserves the nomination. He's excellent. This is an understated story and perhaps my favorite sort of... I think it made the movie more atmospheric because there are these long shots of the ocean because they're in an ocean city, as you might expect, Manchester by the sea.
Mm-hmm.
There are these long shots of the ocean, but these are all working class people that this revolves around. No one here has a great deal of money. They're just working class people. And essentially all of the music in it is these kind of orchestral pieces that don't seemingly fit, but it works so nicely with the scenery and the pacing of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
This really is, it's one of my favorite movies of the year.
Wow, so what do you give it on a scale of 10?
I give it a 9 out of 10. This is an excellent movie.
Manchester by the Sea.
And now I have some context, because I go to see all of the blockbusters through the summer.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily your cup of tea all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I miss movies like Denial. But as part of the St. Louis Film Critics, we're getting ready to vote on all those in the next week.
Mm-hmm.
So I've now seen... Over the past week and a half, I've watched all of the heavy movies from the year. So,
did you see Denial?
I saw Denial.
Which I think is one of the best movies of the year.
I can't disagree with that. It was very, very good. I really like Rachel Weisz in that. Tom Wilkinson is... He's going to get a... If I had to guess, he's probably going to end up with the best supporting actor.
He has to. He's fantastic
in
that movie.
And it's him. Like, how many more performances are we going to get out of him in movies like this?
The guy doesn't give you... He's incapable of a bad performance.
Yes. But a movie like that... Yeah, so I've just been watching all the heavy movies, which mm-hmm. is, you know, great to watch like 10 or 15 sort of depressing dramas in the course of a week.
Yeah. Was the teenager's name Lucas Hedges?
Yes, that's okay. It. Oh, my God, he's so good in this. He's... Yeah.
Okay.
And he and... It sounds odd. He and Casey Affleck have amazing chemistry, as is... You believe the relationship. Every step of it, it's... Because it's couched off that. If it feels false that... Oh, this... No. They work together so well, and it's... And you get to see their relationship grow. Just go see this. Okay. It's really good.
All right. Now, because we weren't on last week, we have to catch up on some movies that opened on Thanksgiving week. Thanksgiving Wednesday, actually, was the day that they opened.
Yes.
And I went to see a movie. You know, you talk about a slow character-based story, you know, a drama that has those heavy elements to it. I went to see one of those this week. Bad Santa 2.
Hey!
I saw that.
You did?
Yes.
Why don't you review it?
8 out of 10.
I actually liked it,
mm-hmm.
but I thought it was really raunchy.
Yes. That's exactly my review, Dan.
Yeah.
Because I went to see it because I liked the first one so much.
I did, too.
And I like Billy Bob Thornton. And, in fact, in a few minutes, I'm going to talk about a show that he's in that's streaming on Amazon that I really recommend. I'll get to that in a couple minutes. But I went to see it because I liked the first one so much. And I heard he's back in this one. And Tony Cox, the little person who was his sidekick in the first one, is back. And the guy who played Thurman Merman, Brett Kelly, is back. Now, what, 10, 13? How many years ago was the first one?
Yeah, 13. I don't know.
13 years ago. So he's 13 years older now, but still is immature.
And Kathy Bates.
And Kathy Bates is in this as Billy Bob Thornton's mother. And if you thought Billy Bob Thornton was a bad guy in the first movie, you understand that the apple didn't fall anywhere far from the tree.
No, you know where he got it from.
Absolutely.
Interesting fact about Kathy Bates. 13 years ago, she was 30 years younger. That's how Kathy Bates ages, because she has not looked good in 3 decades.
Well,
this
is
true.
She's actually perfect for the role in this. And Christina Hendricks from Mad Men, she's in this as well. She plays the woman who runs the charity that Kathy Bates, Billy Bob Thornton, and Tony Cox are going to rip off at Christmas time. But Dan is exactly right. This movie is crude.
Yeah.
And you guys both saw Sausage Party.
Yes.
Yes.
Crudeness
equal.
Really? Oh, yeah, I would say so.
Let me put it this way. If I were to go online and ask you to find 15 seconds of audio from Bad Santa 2 that we can play on the radio, you couldn't find it.
Wow,
there's no time when 15 seconds goes by without somebody saying the F-bomb or something seriously close to that or something sexual.
Yeah.
And when I say something sexual, there are a few scenes in this movie where I said, whoa!
Cover my eyes.
Wow.
Really?
But I didn't cover my eyes.
Yeah. So, like we said with Sausage Party, do not take kids to this.
Yes.
No.
You know, don't think, well, I'll take my 14-year-old. No, don't. Don't do that. Unless you want to start answering a lot of questions in the car on the way home, don't let your teenage kid see this movie.
There are a couple of scenes in there that you may be uncomfortable with if you have a 25-year-old kid with you.
he's not wrong. Now, that being said, there are parts of this movie that are quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go into this movie knowing what you're going to get, I mean, you don't go see Bad Santa 2 and expect Manchester by the Sea. It ain't going to be that. It's going to be exactly what you thought it was going to be, just not as funny as the first one. I think they tamped down the funny and ramped up the raunchy.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be a way to describe it?
I would think so. Yeah.
So I can't really give it a great review. I don't know. What do you think, Dan? Like a 6, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that's a good one.
6 out of 10.
But still funny enough. Just not as funny.
Yeah, there's some really funny parts in there.
If you want to see a funny Bad Santa movie, get Bad Santa.
Mm-hmm.
Watch that movie again.
It sounds like what happened with Ted and Ted 2.
I didn't see either of those.
Oh, see, Ted was the original, I thought, was very, very funny. And Ted 2, I still laughed. But there was one scene, and Dan knows what I'm talking about, in a bank of sorts that just crossed all sorts of lines.
Yeah.
So they just made it way more raunchy in the second.
Well, see, I think that becomes the default when people have to make a sequel to a movie that was already pretty raunchy to begin with, but was really funny. All the funny stuff was in Bad Santa 2. I mean, Bad Santa, the original movie.
Yeah.
And then when they came back and made the second one, they really couldn't come up with as many funny situations. There is some funny stuff between Kathy Bates and Tony Cox and Billy Bob Thornton. The three of them, when any two of them are in the scene together, there's some good chemistry and good funny stuff there. But the stuff with Thurman Merman, I didn't think was that funny.
No, I didn't. He was like maybe over the top stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, nobody could be that stupid, but we're in radio, so we have worked with a few people like that, I guess.
I don't want to mention any initials, but his name...
His name is...
I was going to say it. I decided not to, because my lawyer is listening, and he doesn't need a bonus at this time of the year. So there you go. 6 out of 10 for Bad Santa. Now, I'd like to turn my attention to another movie I saw that opened last week.
You saw a lot last week.
Yeah, I did. A movie that is going to be on my worst movies of the year list. We will do that on our final show of the year 4 weeks from today.
Yes.
And this movie is going to be on that list. It's a movie called Nocturnal Animals, which is getting some hype because Hollywood falls for garbage like this. But I don't. And I'm going to tell you right now, there are two Amy Adams movies out right now in theaters. One is Arrival, which will be on my best of the year list. Mm-hmm. The other one is Nocturnal Animals, which you should not go to see. It is really, really bad. The writer-director, Tom Ford, who, he's from the world of fashion, just like me. I know nothing. I know nothing about fashion. I'd never heard of Tom Ford. I don't know who he is. Maybe he's good at fashion, but he's very bad at movies. This movie starts out with one of the most visually disturbing sequences of the year. It is a bunch of very overweight, middle-aged women dancing completely naked.
Ew.
That's the full screen.
What?
Individual women who shouldn't... By the way, this is not a matter of fat shaming, because I'll say it about myself. I shouldn't be on the screen dancing naked. No one should see me naked. No one should see these women naked either. And it goes on for the opening credits for several minutes. And there's no reason for it. I actually thought to myself, have I ever walked out of a movie during the opening credits? Because I was very close to do it. It is a jarring way to start this movie and made me less than hopeful about what was to follow.
Is there context for it? Or is, like, is it supplied later on?
They are part of an exhibition at an art gallery owned by the Amy Adams character, where they're dancing on pedestals, and then they lay down on these pedestals, and that's art. Now,
how many
times, Dan, have we said on this show, we don't get art?
No.
We don't know what, you go to the Contemporary Art Museum, you look at stuff, you go, okay, it looks green. That's what I get from this. It's green. That one's blue. I don't understand it. And by the way, if you're into that stuff, fine. I'm not saying it shouldn't be out there. Just don't make me watch it. And the same thing with the fat women dancing. There's just no reason for it. But that sets you up for the pretentious world of Tom Ford and his characters, including this woman, Susan, who's played by Amy Adams, who is a wealthy art gallery owner.
Now, if Amy Adams was dancing naked,
now you got a movie.
Yeah.
So she's in this movie, and at no time is she naked. But she's unhappy with her life, particularly because her husband, who's played by Armie Hammer, seems completely uninterested in her. So obviously he's an idiot.
Yes.
Then one day, one of her servants, I told you, it's the pretentious world of art.
He has a cousin named Marine Screwdriver.
Right.
Oh, my God.
One day, one of her servants brings her a package that's just been delivered to the house, and inside, she opens it up, she finds a manuscript by her first husband, Edward, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal. And Susan sits down to read the manuscript. And the only thing you essentially see Amy Adams do for the rest of the movie is read the manuscript. Meanwhile, we are taken inside the story of what the story is of that manuscript, which is Jake Gyllenhaal's character, who is played in the story within the story by Jake Gyllenhaal, because she's imagining this as she's reading. You know, when you read a book, you kind of mentally cast the characters to look the way you want. So she casts the man in that story to be just like her ex-husband, Jake Gyllenhaal. He plays a guy named Tony, whose wife and daughter and he are driving on a two-lane road through the night in Texas. They are run off the road by three thugs who take the mother and daughter and the car and beat the crap out of Tony and leave him in the middle of nowhere. He eventually finds his way to a farmhouse, uses a phone to call the cops, and now we meet Detective Bobby Andes, who's played by Michael Shannon, who is the only interesting character in this movie.
Just give me the facts there.
Anytime you bring him in as a detective, you've got something good. And he works the case, and he discovers that Tony's wife and daughter were raped and murdered. So this is the kind of the action drama story that's playing out within the main story. And Tom Ford, the director, takes us back to see Amy Adams sitting there reading the book. And sometimes she puts it aside, and then she picks it back up, and she reads it some more. I'm telling you, she has nothing to do in this movie. Nothing. So we keep going back inside that story, within the story, and between that and her artsy-fartsy life and her domestic problems, I never cared about anybody in this movie. Now, if this was a movie about what happened to Jake Gyllenhaal and his wife, who's played by Isla Fisher, and their daughter, and the Michael Shannon character investigating the crime and all that sort of stuff, it might have been okay. But even that is not that compelling a story. From beginning to end, I did not like one single thing about Nocturnal Animals.
Especially the fat, naked women dancing.
Correct.
I liked them, though. When you Andy 48 pack, and they look pretty darn good to me.
Thank you, Mike. When you make a movie this bad with Amy Adams, Jake Gyllenhaal, Michael Shannon, Isla Fisher, Laura Linney, Michael Sheen is even in it for one scene, you have blown an opportunity. I'm giving this a 1 out of 10.
Really?
Yes. Ooh. It will be on my worst movies of the year
list. So what you're saying is she's a less engaging, like, Peter Falk from The Princess Bride? that's what happened. Like, at least he's teaching Fred Savage something in the course of that book while he's reading or
yes.
the movie.
Yes.
She's pardon less me. Am I bothering you? Yes. Am I bothering you over there?
That's exactly.
I'm just lining up for Dan here. This is great.
You know what? That's actually a pretty good analogy. If somebody, wait, but if somebody told you The Princess Bride is a Peter Falk movie, you might not have gone to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Peter Falk. One of my all-time favorite movies is him and Alan Arkin in The In-Laws.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Serpentine. Serpentine, yeah. Shell. Serpentine. That's a great movie. But The Princess Bride is not about the Peter Falk character. It's about what happens with Carrie Elwes and Robin Wright and Andre the Giant and all the rest
it's
of the people
like
who come in
with,
there.
It's kind of like that movie with Don Knotts, right, Dan?
You smart ass.
He's lost his Don Knotts.
Lost my Don Knotts.
He can't do it anymore. Hey!
See?
He can't get up there anymore. No. The high Don Knotts register is gone.
No, I know.
By the way, if Don Knotts had been in Nocturnal Animals, I still wouldn't like it. That's how bad this movie is. Don't go see it. Trust me, if you want to see Amy Adams in a movie, and you should, go see Arrival. Do not go see Nocturnal Animals.
Oh.
Wow, is it bad. Now, we got to take a break. When we come back, we still have a couple more movies and a whole bunch of TV stuff we have to get to as we catch up with the last week and a half of showbiz here on the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Dan Strauss is here with me. Josh Gilbert is filling in for Ian behind the control board. And Colin Jeffries here. And we're talking about showbiz. And we've already given reviews of Nocturnal Animals, 1 out of 10. Bad Santa, 6 out of 10. And Manchester by the Sea, 9 out of 10. There are a couple more movies that have opened up in the last week or so that we did not get a chance to review, including a Disney animated movie that you saw.
Yes, Moana is what I saw. This got a lot of buzz leading up to it before its release because the music was done in part by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Okay.
Who?
Mr. Hamilton.
Hamilton. Yes. That's who that is. And he wrote, he wrote the lyrics for the main song, like the song your kids are going to be singing if you've seen this movie.
The song that'll be up for Song of the Year at the Oscars?
Yes, that
one. Which nobody ever remembers.
No, other than who won?
Elton John.
3-6 Mafia won.
Oh, yeah.
For Hustle and Flow, I believe.
Yeah, it's hard out here for a pimp.
Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah.
Elton John Oscar and 3-6 Mafia have that in common. So Moana it's a departure from typical Disney. Not because necessarily that it just doesn't involve sort of like Europeans or white people. It centers around sort of ancient Polynesian Pacific Islanders, but that the lead female, for the first time I can remember, does not have a love interest. Hmm. Moana is the daughter of the chief of this island, and the island is struggling. There's a presence out there, and we're introduced to this early in the movie. There's a presence that is causing the island and the sea to not be bountiful. They can't go grow crops anymore. They can't find fish anywhere around the island.
Mm-hmm.
And this all stems from the fact that a demigod, played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson, named Maui, a long time ago stole like the stone of life from.
Is this a true story?
There was.
Based on.
Oh, okay,
no,
good.
Sadly.
I hate when they steal the stone of life.
Man.
So he stole this stone that would imbue. He said he did it to give to humans so they could create life, any life they needed to make things easier. Instead, he lost it into the depths of the sea.
I hate when they lose the stone of life.
Exactly. Oh, man.
And so Moana follows this call, and this is really good. With a 5-year-old daughter watching this movie with me, I was happy to see this. Perhaps what sets this aside even more than me not having a love interest, if we compare it to the other major princesses in Disney canon, yes, Snow White goes out in an attempt to carve her own path in a way, but really it's just to avoid getting married, and she ends up getting married. Like, they all end up doing what they're supposed to. Well, here she says, No, I'm not just going to stay here and lead the people and make the best of the situation. I'm going to go out there and be an adventurer and leave the island, despite your explicit instructions, Father, to stay here to solve this problem because I think it's what's best for my people. Mm-hmm. And someday I'm going to have to lead them. So she goes out and does it. And she tracks down Maui and says, hey, you've got to come with me and we're going to go find this stone and take care of business. That's the premise of the story. It has all the Disney trademarks. You know, Maui's kind of the wisecracking, funny guy. They have a little character that's along with them called Hey Hey. It's a little insane-looking chicken that is nuts. And then the extra
is that supposed to be like the Gilbert Gottfried parrot from Aladdin?
Except it can't speak. It just kind of makes noises, and just squawks and has crazy eyes and keeps walking off the boat into the ocean, which would seem disastrous, other than the ocean is a character. It chose Moana when she was a baby to be the one that's going to go find this, and now she's realizing her destiny in that way.
Mm-hmm.
This movie has... It's very, very good. The story's good. I'm happy to see a strong female character that says, no, I'm going to carve my own path and do this. That's really good to see. Where it falls, this is my only critique of the movie, which is odd. It feels like a simple quest. Like, I just need to go get this, and we know where the story's going to go. It's not necessarily anything new from that respect.
Sounds in that regard like the Pixar movie Brave, which was about Merida, the real long redhead girl who...
Scottish, I think she
Scottish,
was.
Scottish, yeah. So she didn't want to do what her dad said, which was to be a girl. She wanted to be able to shoot her bow and arrow.
Yeah, the Pixar film. Yeah, and there's similarities. But where it falls short is it doesn't feel 100% authentic Polynesian. And if you go back in from this year, if you see Kubo and the Two Strings, which is Japanese through and through, like that's... You couldn't do the Kubo and the Two Strings story in any other background, ethnic background. Or if you go back 1 or 2 years ago to Book of Life, that's about the Day of the Dead. Imagine Prince Charming traveling into the underworld to rescue the woman that died and sacrificing his own life and dealing with mortality and what happens afterwards and the importance of family that's dead. Like, Disney's not going to... They couldn't do that with a... This feels like they could have sort of shuffled a few things around and it would have been just as at home with white characters. And I feel bad saying it's a very good movie. That's a nitpicky thing I'm explaining, but... I have to be critical of the things that bother... And that's the only thing that bothers me. Don't let it... Go see this movie.
Does it work for parents as well as for kids?
Oh, yeah. 100%. This is Disney sort of hitting across the board. And it doesn't have too many shout-outs to, like, things that only parents would get. Everything that would... It's enough that your kids will laugh at it, and you will laugh at a lot of the similar things. It's Disney in that way, and your kids are going to be singing these songs. Like, you're going to own this, and this is the new set of Frozen-type songs.
Frozen, okay, yeah.
Yeah, especially Maui's song. The boys are going to love that because it's sort of half-spoken, half-sung because it's Wayne Johnson, but it's a lot of fun. Go see this. It's really good. 8 out of 10. It's one of the best animated movies of the year.
Moana. Okay. Another movie that opened up last week, which we didn't get a chance to review, is called Rules Don't Apply, which is a movie made by Warren Beatty, who, you know, if you look at this man's career, he has not made that many movies. But he made some good ones. Bonnie and Clyde, Shampoo, Heaven Can Wait, Reds, Bugsy, which I just watched again earlier this year. There are some
Bullworth.
Scenes. I didn't like Bullworth all that much.
Dick Tracy.
I didn't like that all that much. Ishtar. I know. Love Affair. Well, what I was going to say
he's
actually hit and miss.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you think about the fact that he's got a 50-year career, we can't even name more than 9 or 10 movies in all those years that he's done as actor, director, producer, writer. Now he's back with his first movie that he's appeared in 15 years, and the first movie he's directed in 18 years. It's called Rules Don't Apply, and it's another telling of part of the life of Howard Hughes, which was already done, as far as I'm concerned, by Martin Scorsese in his movie The Aviator, with Leonardo DiCaprio playing Howard Hughes, and Cate Blanchett won an Academy Award for playing Katharine Hepburn in that movie. She was very good. And there's also a kind of Hughes-adjacent movie from 1980 called Melvin and Howard, with Paul LaMatte as this guy named Melvin Dumar, who told people that the reason he was mentioned in Howard Hughes' will is because he had picked him up in the desert one night looking like a bum and gave him a ride. And you see that in that movie with Jason Robards as Howard Hughes and Paul LaMatte playing this guy, Melvin, and Mary Steenburgen, I think, was nominated for an Academy Award for playing Paul LaMatte's wife in that movie. So those are two good Howard Hughes movies. And then you get this one. Howard Hughes, if you don't know, he had a career in Hollywood for many, many years. He produced the original Scarface, the original The Front Page. He owned the RKO movie studio for about a decade and a half, at the same time that he also was a big shot in the aviation industry with Hughes Aircraft and as a defense contractor and a notorious eccentric. Beatty plays Hughes during that period where he's got all those things going on. But believe it or not, the Howard Hughes movie is not really that much about Howard Hughes. It's about people around him, and in particular, a young actress named Marla Mabry, who's played by an actress named Lily Collins, who has two earthworms for eyebrows. They are they are the thickest eyebrows I've seen on
like
an actress in a long time.
Type, yeah,
they're very good, yes. Yeah. Very much like that. Marla Mabry's been brought to Hollywood by Howard Hughes, along with two dozen other aspiring actresses. And like the others, Hughes sets her up in her own bungalow, promising her a screen test. And she goes to Hollywood with her mother, who's played by Annette Bening, who's Warren Beatty's real-life wife. She eventually leaves in frustration because she's unclear about what her daughter's deal is with Hughes, and we don't see enough of her because she's gone a third of the way into the movie. And meanwhile, Hughes assigns one of his drivers, Frank Forbes, to chauffeur this actress around town. That chauffeur is played by Alden Ehrenreich, who we saw for the first time in Hail Caesar last year.
And is now
young Han Solo.
Yes.
In an upcoming Star Wars movie, one of the Star Wars prequels, right?
Yes, it's one of the anthology ones, yeah.
Okay, so Mabry and Forbes take an instant liking to each other, but it's sexually repressive 1958, and so their relationship remains chaste, while their chemistry makes for some interesting repartee. But Forbes is reminded repeatedly, you can't date any of the contract girls. You may like her, but you cannot date her. She's Howard Hughes' contract girl. You have to stay away. He's reminded of that by this guy named LeVar, who's played by Matthew Broderick. And if it sounds like I'm mentioning a lot of people who are in this movie whose names you know, that's what goes on here. I'll get to the supporting cast in a minute. You won't believe it. Then there's Warren Beatty's portrayal of Hughes himself. Hughes put OCD into a new category. He was not just a germaphobe. He was he didn't like light. So many of the scenes in this movie are shot in dark rooms with interesting cinematography, giving it a lot of light and shadow. And as Hughes gets more eccentric and doesn't want to be around people, he relies more and more on the Forbes and Mathis characters to even keep his associates at bay. It's all played very strangely because that's the kind of guy Hughes was. He was strange. But still, Beatty's version comes off as more of a straight-up weirdo with a litany of odd demands about ice cream and all sorts of other things that may or may not be part of the Hughes legend, but they just come off as weird on screen. And there's one other thing about this movie that's very odd. Beatty, who wrote and directed the movie in addition to starring in it, uses a lot of smash cuts. You know what that is? That's where you have a short scene, maybe 4, 5, 6 seconds long, and as soon as that's over, he edits immediately to another scene where something completely different is going on. And that scene doesn't last very long before he smash cuts to another scene. And there's a lot of that, so you get kind of a whiplash effect between these scenes. There's a reason he needed 4 editors on this movie.
Oh, wow.
I've never seen a movie that had more than 1 or maybe 2 editors. This one has 4 editors in the credits, along, by the way, with 18 producers. And I mentioned that it's got an unusual supporting cast. Candice Bergen, Martin Sheen, Paul Sorvino, Haley Bennett, Ed Harris, Amy Madigan, Oliver Platt, Alec Baldwin, Steve Coogan, and even Dabney Coleman show up, although some of them are in it for exactly one scene. Smash cut, they're gone, and you never see them again. So if you want to see a really good Howard Hughes movie, go see The Aviator.
Yes.
Which came out long ago, and Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio did a very good job, and Cate Blanchett won an Oscar for. That's very good. I don't think we really needed another Howard Hughes movie. This one is kind of passing entertainment. It's not great. It's not horrible. I give it a 6.5, but it didn't really need to be made in the first place.
That's frustrating.
And the whole Warren Beatty, you know, Hollywood legend thing, I don't think has helped much by this movie.
No.
It may be closer to Bullworth on the scale than Bonnie and Clyde and Shampoo and Heaven Can Wait.
It's always good when you compare a movie to a rapping politician.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Wow, I thought a smash cut was, hey, my man, why don't you cut that out, baby? What's going on?
That's also a smash cut.
Yeah.
And we edit right from that to a couple of other things. David Pogue mentioned last hour that Netflix is now allowing you to download your video onto your portable device. Now, this doesn't work for laptops, but if you've got a tablet like an iPad or a smartphone, you can download things from there and then watch them when you're not in Wi-Fi. So you download them in Wi-Fi, and then if you're someplace else, like if you're traveling this holiday season, you're flying somewhere, you don't want to have to pay for Wi-Fi on board the plane, you can download things from Netflix the way you could for the last 2 years from Amazon Prime. You have it on your device, and you can watch it without having to pay for Wi-Fi. That's the first time Netflix has done it. Now, it's not for everything on Netflix, just like it's not for everything on Amazon Prime, but there are quite a few things that are available. You and I have talked about this series, Black Mirror, mm-hmm. that we loved, and which is back for a third season on Netflix now, 6 episodes long. I've only watched 2, so I've got 4 others. I've already downloaded them to my iPad.
Have you seen the social media episode, the rating one another?
That's the very first one of this, yeah. Yes. Excellent.
Yeah.
With Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you're a Netflix user, download the new version of the app. You have to upgrade your app, update the app, and then you'll be able to download some of the shows that you can watch when you're not in Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Instead of using up your cellular data. So that's good. Now, speaking of streaming stuff, I mentioned a half hour ago when I was talking about Bad Santa, I was going to recommend a Billy Bob Thornton project for you. There's something streaming on Amazon Prime right now called Goliath. It's 9 or 8 episode series with Billy Bob Thornton playing a formerly great lawyer who's down on his luck because he drank his way to the bottom. He's living in a motel. He's divorced. His ex-wife is played by Maria Bello. He's got a kid who he doesn't really get to see. He also has his ex-law partners in a firm that still has his name on it, but it's run by a kind of evil character played by William Hurt. And he takes them on, Billy Bob Thornton's character, takes on this old William Hurt character and his law firm in a lawsuit over a guy who may or may not have committed suicide at sea because there was a huge explosion on this boat. And There's a huge lawsuit that comes from it, and Billy Bob Thornton is tasked with doing it. It's a little reminiscent of the Paul Newman movie, The Verdict, in which he played a formerly great lawyer who drank his way to the bottom and then got a case that could save his career and his life. It's a little bit like that, but I like Billy Bob so much. He's so good. And Hurt is very good. And Molly Parker, who plays the chief attorney for William Hurt's firm, is very good in this. You may have seen her in House of Cards as the congresswoman who's scheming with Kevin Spacey's character in that. It's called Goliath. It's on Amazon. It's worth your time, as is one other thing on Amazon, which I'm still in the middle of watching, which is called Good Girls Revolt. Which
I've heard great stuff about it.
If you remember, Mad Men was about mostly men working at ad agencies in the 60s, Don Draper, played by John Hamm, and the others. Well, this show takes place in 1969, and it's as if you had continued along with the characters of Peggy and Joan. They're not in this, but it's kind of the change of attitude and the beginnings of the feminist movement in 1969 centered on young women who worked at a news weekly. Not Newsweek, not Time. They call it News of the Week, although it's based on a real case involving a woman named Lynn Povich, Maury's sister, who wrote a book about the lawsuit that she and her colleagues filed against Newsweek in 1969 because they were not allowed to be reporters. Only men can be reporters. Women have to be researchers and secretaries. And so that's what this show is about. And it's very intriguing, and it's very good, and the soundtrack is full with lots of classic rock stuff, so I love that. It's called Good Girls Revolt. Like I said, I'm only halfway through the first season. Don't know if there's going to be a second season of either of these shows, but I recommend both Goliath and Good Girls Girls Revolt.
Fair enough.
And that's all the showbiz stuff we have for you today. Colin's got the news headlines at the top of the hour, and then I'll be back after that with the Harris Challenge and Mike Evans and Knuckleheads of the News. We're glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS.